I read an article in 2016 in The Independent called, "Is it 1914 all over again? We are in danger of repeating the mistakes that started World War I," says a leading historian. The article lays out some equivalencies of today's conditions. I found the concept to be somewhat compelling, and like many things, I felt there was just so much I didn't know about World War I. I had made a mental note to go back and learn more about it. Years after that, I came across an ebook someone had given me about World War I and started to read it, but that was unsuccessful too. So fast forward to this year, and I remembered how much I enjoyed Dan Carlin's podcast called King of Kings that I let play through while I was painting our house. I decided to give his podcast on World War I called Blueprint for Armageddon a whirl and see where that took me. To say it's been a bit unsettling would be an understatement. Maybe it's my own feeling of vulnerability I am prey to now that I'm a father. I really can't enjoy the horror of an incoming disaster that I can't protect my kids from. So as I've been listening to how the world had never seen terror and massive death in such a short period of time as when this war began, I was watching the death tolls rise on COVID-19. I was listening to Blueprint for Armageddon while I was working on the yard yesterday, and he recounted the Germans for using gas on the first time and the horror of it. The gas attack was also unprecedented, a word which has been thrown around in our vocabulary liberally today. Just like the economists during World War I expected the war to end quickly because the nations would run out of liquidity, we find ourselves in a similar situation today. It doesn't look like this will end quickly, and the world we walk out into may be drastically different than what preceded it. As you listen to the recounting of history, you find out that certain events bared the future we are living today. So what does this have to do with our podcast? This quarantine we are facing in the world leads to some time at home that we normally don't have. I really haven't been feeling it lately to create much, so I was sitting on the back porch just listening to the birds and decided to go ahead and do this podcast on Creative Field Recording. We are all living in different spaces, now isolated from one another. What a perfect time to capture some of this ambience and feeling we are all in collectively. Even though a lot of companies are offering free courses and access to resources to sharpen or learn new skills, I just think maybe it's best to take a look and listen at what is currently around us and see what can be done with it. So what is field recording? It can range from anything from recording shows in person to going out into the woods and recording nature or even cityscapes. There are some amazing options for field recording today using our cell phone technology. Also, of course, standalone recorders. Tascam and Zoom make a lot of affordable options, as well as professional level gear to get you started. On iOS, there's a Fieldscape app. Sennheiser, Hook Audio, and other companies are offering what's called binaural 3D audio, which is amazing to listen to on headphones. I will link these headphones and some other competitor demos in the description. I really enjoyed listening to the soundtrack of the guy riding his motorcycle through Japan with his 3D headphones on. They are Roland CS10 EMs. Watching him walk and ride through Japan is really awesome. You can really get lost in the sound of the bike and the visuals of the biker riding through the city. Another great video I will link is someone walking through New York City in a thunderstorm. The passing conversations, the water sounds all around you, and the thunder above, it's really immersive and impressive. The immersiveness of binaural recordings for me bring a feeling of memories lost, a forgotten, dream, memory-like state. Remember the movie Strange Days and the illegal tapes? Maybe that idea got stuck in my subconscious as a kid when I watched it. So when I discovered the podcast framework, I really got sucked in. Sound hunting. The whole concept is just fascinating to me. Framework is a fantastic podcast to see how field recordings can be used creatively. I will link their website and podcast in the description. Let me tell you what I know about Framework. They put out issues every second week. Here's how they describe themselves. Framework began broadcasting in June 2002 on the newly reformed Resonance 104.4 FM in London. The show now airs on 12 radio stations around the world, with regular new additions to its broadcast family and streams and podcasts here on its own website. Framework is consecrated to field recording and its use in composition, and began broadcasting at a time when a new community of sound artists with a special interest in found sound was developing. A community spread across the globe that, thanks to the internet, was no longer limited to a specific geography. Framework sees itself as an outlet for this ever-growing and developing community, a folk tool in a new folk movement, a community-driven exchange point for creators and listeners alike. Framework's goal is to present not only the extremely diverse sound environments of our world, but also the extremely diverse work that is being produced by the artists who choose to use these environments as their sonic sources. We hope to ask this question: is field recording a style or a genre, or is it in fact as uncontrollable and undefinable an instrument or tool as any that may be interpreted, manipulated, and appropriated by anyone with a microphone and an idea? These works are its definition and not vice versa. So I'm going to pick an episode and just kind of describe it to you. I'll start with episode number 437, Wusan Cheng. Now you really need to throw on some earbuds and experience these, but I'm going to try my best just to describe them to you. This one starts out with nature, birds singing, insects, but then a motor vehicle slams through the scene. It returns back to the nature sound. I can't tell if he's manipulating the insects with delay or not. Now I'm starting to get sucked in. Then we transition into a storm and rain. There's an unfamiliar sounding bird still calling over top of the thunderstorm. The recording transitions into more scenes and return into what sounds like horns over top of a city soundscape. The city is alive, but clearly there is some kind of indigenous music overpowering the city sounds. The music stops with loud bangs of fireworks, and the city noises come back in shortly afterwards. You get the idea. It's almost like traveling in some episodes because you are really hearing a place as it is. Episode 599, Jason Kahn, May 21st, 2017, Capital Steel from Beijing, China. This one starts out with the narrator walking. The author tells you he's walking from the subway to Capital Steel. This podcast is narrated. The spoken word description of the things he sees is different from any of the episodes I've heard on here. Not many sounds on this one other than footsteps and where he's at. It's more like an audio travelogue from what I can tell. Now let's check out episode 701, D.L. Lutz, entitled Earscape Storm. This episode is creative use of soundscaping. You need to experience this one for yourself. The first part of this reminds me of train brakes, maybe with effects on it. It then moves into some wind sounds. A voice comes in and speaks to the listener and explains that all these sounds are from nature. I want you to accept the author's invitation to get some tea and sit in an armchair and experience this one for yourself. Tell me what you think on Twitter if you have time. I have linked the episode to the description of this podcast. But you can look it up on Apple Podcast or the Pocket Cast app, which I've really started to like. It's under Framework Radio. Framework has a vast number of shows available to listen to. I highly recommend your best headphones. Some of the episodes include great use of spatial effects and sometimes insanely creative use of everyday sounds. I enjoy putting an episode on my headphones in bed and falling asleep to it. Of course, you might wake up in a state of confusion, but that's the fun part for me. Now, I'll go ahead and tell you, this podcast really did take a hold of me, and I ended up buying a Tascam DR100 from Guitar Center used. Now, let's be clear, I am a dreamer, and I really try to do too much with music, but I'm very interested in incorporating this art form into my work. My first outing with the recorder was at a waterfall and on a trail, which had a stream running up to the falls. I recorded my kids and some cousins hitting some rocks against large rocks. I was able to sample that and make it into a beat fairly quickly, along with them talking about the falls and how much they loved it. I took that, added a beat and a synth bass line into a simple little jam. It was really fun. I recorded some ocean sounds this past summer at the beach, but I haven't had time to work that into a project just yet. My vision is to take these synths and interlace the ocean sound, try to match up some frequencies and see what I can come up with. I think that's going to be difficult and way outside my comfort zone, but I do look forward to the challenge. I have a lot of pedals and VSTs, so I feel like the possibilities of sound design with field recording are endless. I think what intrigues me the most about field recording is that everyone is a listener. We are drowning in ambience all the time. Sound is the companion to all thought, meditation, emotion, etc. Even the emptiness of a quiet room can be deafening. Zen Guitar, Part 2. When I see these missteps, I feel like they could apply to most anything you're trying to accomplish in life, and these are the 12 common missteps. We'll start with self-doubt. Being content and happy with who you are on your instrument seems easy enough, right? Pseudo states that the feeling of self-doubt means you've lost your beginner's mind. A good takeaway is to rediscover the joy of beginning and your doubt will vanish. Instant gratification. I think this is pretty self-explanatory. You're going to have to put in the work over time. Success isn't something you can just force overnight. Ego. If you're familiar with Eckhart Tolle and his views on the ego and self or any other of those type of people, you'll understand the concept Pseudo is conveying here. He points out that some of the gunslinging that goes on in the guitar world, I think that was more of an 80s thing, but competition and ego-boosting attitudes. One should strive to make sound with the purity of the bird in the wild. That is the way of Zen guitar. Half-heartedness. Of course, don't do something half-hearted. You have to commit your heart to training for Zen guitar. Over-earnestness. Don't try too hard. Don't overdo it with pyrotechnics. What we do call them now are tryhards. Speed. Music is not a race. Make sure you understand tempo, pacing, timing, and quickness. Notes are expensive. Spend them wisely. That's what B.B. King says. Competition. The only opponent is within. Jazz musicians are able to use musical chops and competition in a healthy way to bring out the best in each other. Remember, cutting heads from the movie Crossroads? A friend of mine and I used to go over to a guy's house and set up our guitars and just go back and forth over some beers with some friends watching closely. It was really fun. It was a healthy competition. I always admired his ability to channel legends like Slash, SRV, and Jimi Hendrix and his technical ability to do it. My style was more bluesy, but incorporated my metal influences. I think it was fun for everybody that used to come and listen, and I always cherish the memories of cutting heads back then. If you can find a person to exercise this with, it's worth it as long as it stays healthy. Obsession. I was watching Forbidden Kingdom the other day, and the student starts asking if he would be learning move after move after move while the teacher was filling his cup. The teacher replies, "How can I teach you if your cup is already full?" I think this is exactly what I took from this chapter about obsession. I'm going to read the following sections because they're fairly short and I also feel like they're all worth reading in their entirety because they are so pertinent to the modern musician. Mishandled criticism. I saw Bob Dylan getting criticized in Australia by this guy who was saying, "Your new songs aren't as relevant as your old songs." And Dylan just said, "Well, I'm out here writing songs. What are you doing?" Tom Petty. The student of Zen guitar needs to know but two things about criticism, how to give it and how to take it. If you must criticize, do so in the spirit of building up, not tearing down. Tearing down is easy. The way of Zen guitar is to build. This is extremely difficult. When receiving criticism, learn from that which is given in the spirit of building. Ignore that which attempts to tear down. Do not allow anything to pierce your armor. Critics can be quick to find fault with an idea, but empty when it comes to providing an alternative. No matter what you do or how respected you are, you can't please everyone. Learn to recognize the different kinds of critics. Those people whose criticism stems from a difference in taste. Just because someone's taste is different doesn't mean it's better. Those who criticize in hindsight without understanding the circumstances of the moment. It's easy to play Monday morning quarterback, and quite a different matter to be on the field facing the blitz. Those whose criticism stems from ego. That is, a desire to show how clever they are, or a feeling of insecurity. Through cutting others, they seek to make themselves look better. Use your training here to become your own best critic. Then no one can tell you what you don't already know. A final word on self-criticism, do not beat up on yourself. Even if you think you know your flaws, there is no need to advertise them. Most people won't have noticed. Failure to adjust. Things turn out better by accident sometimes, but you can't organize accidents. Jeff Beck. There's a lot of randomness in the world. A guitar string breaks in mid-performance, a fuse blows in the amplifier, rain falls on an open-air gig. Try as we might to control the variables in our lives, things happen moment to moment that force us to adjust to changing circumstances. In such cases, learn to see the glass as half full, not half empty, and make the best of the situation. The Japanese word for crisis, kiki, translates two ways, as danger occasion, but also danger opportunity. Look for the opportunity in the chance occurrence. How you react to the unexpected reveals your true spirit. In this dojo, learn to fall like a cat on your feet. I once saw a gig where the band's sound system blew out in the middle of their biggest song. The guitars and vocals went completely dead, and only the live drums made a sound. Without stopping, the band finished the number by leading the audience in a giant sing-along. After that, the sound system returned. But one song remained the defining moment of the show. When things fell apart, the band made art. Sometimes we're lucky, sometimes we're not. Then again, luck can be a matter of attitude. Loss of focus. I remember coming to a concert where they had a big catered meal set out for everyone. I went and said, "Miles, man, you got to see all this food they got here." And Miles said, "I didn't come here to eat." Gary Bartz recalling a conversation with Miles Davis. In Japan, there's a saying, you can't chase two rabbits at once. It reminds us to avoid distraction and stay on course. So often, we lose focus and start running willy-nilly between rabbits instead of making sure we just catch one. Whenever we lose our point of focus, we can usually blame either a lack of concentration or a lack of commitment. In a world of sound bites, quick cuts, and channel surfing, it becomes harder and harder to sustain a complex thought or task. The way of Zen guitar is to fight the short attention span. An exercise that Zen masters use to develop concentration instructs students to sit silently and slowly count from 1 to 10 in their minds. If anything should interrupt their count, self-conscious, a stray thought, awareness of a hearing noise, or even the sound of their own breathing, they must start over from 1. Try this exercise the next time you lose focus. If you can count past 1, you will not lack for concentration. If you can make it to 10, you will know the way of Zen guitar. Lack of commitment. Problems with concentration often result from a lack of commitment. Today, we see many people jumping from job to job and relationship to relationship, starting projects and never following through, just because they can't commit to anything. They wander through life looking for a better path rather than polishing their own. When we look around at what other people have and where they are going, we lose focus on what's important. What we have and where we are going. Yes, there is more than one path to the top of the mountain, but the only one that will get you there is your own. Do not look longingly at the path of others. Give yours and your undivided attention and keep your focus. The farther you go on your own path, the more you will understand every other path. At the end, they all converge. Overthinking. I don't think about the meaning of it all. I say, just plug in your damn guitar and make some noise. Paul Westerberg, The Replacements. Do not analyze things to death. Sometimes the best strategy is ready, fire, aim. Do it first, then make adjustments. The answer lies in actions, not in words. What a great book. I come back to this book when I am stuck on music. It's incredibly simple, but at the same time, the practice is not. I hope you found the discussion on this book to be inspiring not only for guitar, or just anything you're passionate about trying to accomplish. This will conclude our discussion on Zen guitar for the podcast series, but the book does continue. I hope you find time to pick it up and finish it for yourself. Social distancing. What a strange time we're all in. I myself has had my share of anxiety over how this will all end up. I found myself drawn back towards cinema and rekindled my curiosity of creative field recordings. Atmospheric works, in general, tend to bring down my levels of anxiety when my mind might be otherwise too active. I started watching What We Do in the Shadows. I love it so far. It's hilarious. What time I have played on music, I've been exploring the instruments I have that are being neglected. I picked up a semi-modular synthesizer by Pittsburgh Modular called Microvolt 3900 a while back. It's a fantastic synthesizer and the closest thing to an ARP or a Buchla that I can afford. The droning wails I have run through my reverb pedal have caused me to obsessively tinker and manipulate how this thing can arc and shred sound at will. The lack of control I have over it feels kind of fitting for right now, a lot like reality. But something we can control is our playlist, and that brings me to the Midnight album. Now this is going to be a bit different than what I have been discussing. This album does, however, fit perfectly into our discussion on field recording and the feelings that some of the creative ones are evoking. Eliane Rodiga is a French artist, and her album, Trilogie de la Mort, is our Midnight album. Eliane is a fascinating composer. I think the best way to introduce her is by reading some interviews with her rather than me attempt to summarize her works in my own words. Let's start with this interview from The Guardian in 2011. In New York, 1970, Eliane Rodiga met her first synthesizer. It was a Buchla, and looked as early synthesizers did, more like a badly organized telephone switchboard, all dials and dangling wires. The machine was installed at the New York University School of Arts by U.S. composer Morton Subtenick, and Rodiga, a guest composer from France, was not impressed. After the first 3 months, I wondered what on earth I was doing there with this silly machine. Over 40 years later, Rodiga, visiting London for a retrospective of her work, laughs at the recollection. After all, this was the instrument she would go on to develop a deep relationship with, and through which she would evolve a music that, for the select few who came across it, offered rare rewards. Those rewards have not come easily to Rodiga, just as they don't always come easily to the hazy listener. Her painstaking approach to composing, sometimes taking years per piece, leads to music with similar qualities, a tectonic plate of sound that evolves so slowly it seems to move and stay still at the same time. For the first 3 months in front of the synthesizer, I just ejected anything I didn't want. And believe me, there was quite a lot, all of what I would call the big effects. Then finally, I found a tiny little field of sound that interested me, and I just dug under its skin. Rodiga was not stumbling on something new, but rediscovering on a different instrument a sound she was already captivated by. In the 1950s, after hearing radio broadcasts by composer Pierre Schaeffer, she had a chance encounter with him through a friend in Paris. Rodiga went to study concrete music, with Schaeffer and fellow composer Pierre Henry, and later she worked for them as an assistant. I was just cutting, splicing, and editing tape. Of course, at the time, the universe of electronic music was totally male, but I was pleased to do anything they asked of me. I was there to learn, and I was learning by doing, like an apprentice. It wasn't really electronic music I was studying. The studio was against electronic music in favor of concrete music, a simple idea of taking real sounds and manipulating them by cutting, splicing, editing, slowing down, and so on. Rodiga credits Schaeffer with encouraging her to hear the world in a different way. Through him, she realized any sound could be or could contain music. This, she says, was a great antidote to the intellectual gymnastics of the regimented 12-tone and serial music she had been studying, and which Schaeffer thought had made for a century of the most boring music. Despite her love of Schaeffer's brilliance, Rodiga sided artistically with Henry, when she began to develop her own sound using Henry's technique of tape feedback, small cells of sound getting slower and slower, stretched out across time and revealing their microscopic innards. Working with multiple tapes, Rodiga's pieces from this time, the late 60s, were marathons of tape editing and layering. This was the tempo she was happy with. With classical music, I was already very fond of the slow movements, such as the adagio of the Piano Concerto in D by Ravel, she says. I used to jump to the recorder to stop the third movement because after that I didn't want to hear pom pom pom. I had some music within myself which I wanted to take to flight somewhere, somehow. She realized that synthesizers, and in particular the American ARP 2500, offered great potential for this meditative approach. She could build sound from its constituent parts, changing in tiny increments up to 40 parameters such as frequency and modulation, encouraging waves to beat and pulse against each other. The music didn't contain sound. The sound contained the music. She didn't even bother bringing the keyboard part of the art back to France. I could change the sound from the inside. To explain it visually, you could imagine a mountain turning into a cup, but so slowly from one state to another, it takes time by nature. She approached the arp with the same tactile physicality she would apply to the harp or piano, which she also plays, becoming so intuitive that when composer Michel Bakunowski asked her a sound that is the silence of the stars, she didn't even need to fire up the synthesizer. I just went over to it, adjusted a few parameters. Then I switched it on. That was it. Although she does it with humor, Rodiga is fiercely self-critical, describing herself as stubborn, unable to improvise, and constantly imperfect. There is always, in every piece I do, something wrong. Being alone is also a condition that frequently enters the conversation. Though it is never expressed as loneliness, being alone as a woman in the male-dominated world of electronic music, bringing up three children after her marriage to the French-born American artist Armand failed, the solitary nature of composing, her dedication to Buddhism, and its hours of private meditation. This makes her latest musical discovery all the more poignant, since it would seem at face value to be the most easily accessible bonus of music making, company. In 2004, after considerable badgering from bass player Casper T. Toplitz, Rodiga finally accepted his invitation to write an instrumental piece. The results were so revelatory that Rodiga abandoned the synthesizer. All her future work, she says, will be with instrumentalists. The very mention of musicians brings out a blissful smile. Ah, extraordinary. This is what I've been looking for my whole life. When I plugged into that experience of working with a musician, it was so wonderful, sharing that experience of doing music together. I have been working very much alone all my life. My only collaborator was my cat. I thought she was a little bit nervous about this new project with the bass player, but when I saw her being very quiet, I said, okay, maybe this is right. She leans forward conspiratorially. I discuss everything with her. The list of collaborators is growing. Between 2004 and 2009, Rodiga created the tripartite cycle, Nadjorlak, for the cellist Charles Curtis and bassist horn players Carol Robinson and Bruno Martinez. Most recently, she completed Occam 1 with harpist Rodri Davis. It is what I was trying to do with electronic music, but I never succeeded. Every piece felt like a compromise between what I wanted to do and what I could achieve. I think I have been searching for this tremendous emotion that I had when I was 10 or 12 years old, when I was living in Paris and hearing concerts of classical music every Saturday afternoon. A wonderful feeling. It is as if in her 80th year, Rodiga is just starting. She admits without any sentimentality that most of her work is probably behind her now, then laughs and points to the sky. She will, she says, apply for another 10 years and see how that goes. I almost decided to stop in the story where she starts to talk about the later part of her career and she stopped using synthesizers and working with musicians instead, but I almost missed the conclusion of that article that ties us back to Zen guitar. And it shouldn't have surprised me to find this out, given that Eliane is a devout Buddhist. This quote of excitement of her new joy of working with musicians takes her back to the tremendous emotion that she had when she was 10 or 12 years old when living in Paris and hearing concerts of classical music every Saturday afternoon. A wonderful feeling. As related to our conversations from Zen Guitar, it seems she is still able to feel that beginner's mind state, even in her 80s. Now let's take a look at another interview. This one is from Electronic Beats with her, and I'd like to share this with you before we get into the album. Born in Paris in 1932 into a world quite different from today, Eliane Rodiga remains an important, intriguing figure within the European musical avant-garde. She studied under Pierre Schaeffer, the architect of concrete music, in the 1950s, going on to be an assistant for fellow music pioneer Pierre Henry. However, her own experiments, which included tape loops and microphones, were met with some hostility by Schaeffer and Henry, and it became clear that her practice could not be contained by the inflexible principles of the founders. Her work is defined by its painstaking creation and singular methodology. She worked alone for great periods of time, splicing and manipulating sounds to create exquisitely drawn-out compositions that feel sublime yet contain the most extreme delicacy. She was introduced to her first synthesizer in New York in 1970, and from then on her work would be created exclusively on the unwieldy but brilliant ARP 2500 modular synth. However, in her seventh decade, Radeke made the leap into acoustic sound palette, collaborating with such musicians as Charles Curtis and Casper Toplitz. Tonight, she will be taken apart in a gig in Berlin. All right. She's being introduced by Max Dax. Max, you grew up in Paris in the direct neighborhood of Les Halles in the old market halls. I never saw them before they were torn down, but you have. What were they like? The memory lingers on. It's pretty sad that they've destroyed not only this quarter, but also this integral chapter of Paris. I lived on a street that doesn't exist anymore. There's still a house with a plaque that says Rue de Lingerie. Excuse my French, I'm not good. The name of the street where my parents lived, but that is all that's left. There are many books about Les Halles, with old photos and corresponding texts. I ask because when I travel, I always try to visit the big fish, fruit, and meat markets to record the sounds. I do field recordings of the market criers and environmental noise. Whether it's in Athens, in Los Angeles, in Rome, or in London, these places seem to have a very specific sound. And since you deal with sound, with music, and maybe you've noticed it as well. When I was younger, Paris only started to be alive around midnight. Where I lived, it used to be full of people selling vegetables and fruit and people yelling and all that. I remember when I was an adolescent, when I came back at night, I had to cross all of that just to go into the house. The interviewer responds, "It sounds like paradise to me. I mean, we are talking about real sounds that probably no one had thought to record back then. It would have been paradise for you, obviously, but honestly, I didn't like it that much. Already back then, there were a lot of tourists coming just for fun. When I was a young girl, these people were whistling my way, which I disliked completely. I didn't much like to live in this neighborhood. Of course, this place hasn't existed for 40 or 50 years now. It has been transferred. You've worked with one instrument, the ARP 2500, over many years. I saw a TV documentary about you where you prominently say, 'I have music in my head as an idea before I start.' Did you feel that you were at one with your instrument? I cannot start a piece if I do not have an idea of what it would become, or what we may call a theme, but what I would call the spirit. The spirit of what I wanted to do should be there before, because I'm a very poor improviser. And I keep that spirit, that theme in mind, quite often several months before I start to do something. So when I come to make the sounds, it's already there. I know. How you can get it out of the machine? To a certain extent, yes. Not at the beginning, of course. I have been living with my ARP for more than 40 years now, so it's a very long marriage. At the beginning, I had to be more careful, but after a while, it was quite all right. So it takes a long time for you to write a piece of music? Oh yes, it takes quite long. When I first started to be more familiar with my instrument, I made pieces that were of a very long duration, which of course could not be made in one move. This meant I had to prepare a lot in advance. The first move was to make some sounds where I could say, this could be for the beginning, this could be for the end, this for the middle. But after that, it was made out of mixing and overlap, and a final piece would have at least 30 to 40 elements to make the mix. What's more, when I made the first sounds for the piece, I'd leave them for 2 or 3 months in order to listen to everything with a fresh ear, intentionally, to decide which to throw away and which to keep. Then, when I arrived at the final mix, it was kind of a climax, because all the tape had to be ready and in chronological order. From there, I had to manage it, stopping one tape, bringing in another, another one coming out. I had no Pro Tools whatsoever. She laughs. I had to do the whole thing manually. If something was 80 minutes long and something went wrong at 74, everything had to be redone from the very beginning. I want to come back to your quote. It almost sounds like a meditative approach, the idea that you ruminate and think over a piece in order to really hear the music before it exists. It could be so. I have been involved in the meditative process, but this music had been called meditative before I started to use the practice myself. It was always there. Maybe I was more meditative than I am now. Who knows? When you work on a major piece, you said that you do the parts separately. How do you know one part belongs to the same piece? It goes with what I call the spirit of the piece. Let me give you a practical example of Jetson Mila piece, which is about the life of the great yogi and poet Milarepa. As far as I remember, 9 men passed through his life, his birth, his ordeals. It has a spiritual or mental color, and I have to translate this into certain kinds of sounds. Therefore, I made sounds that fit with every shade. Sometimes, when this was too complex, I did some pre-mixing to avoid being left with all the separate colors at the end. This was a framework, these pre-mixed pieces, which helped simplify my work. Jetson Mila was the first piece of my trilogy on death and featured the 6 intermediate stages of consciousness, 3 during lifetime and 3 during between death and rebirth, according to the Tibetan tradition. The story was there. I just had to follow it. I still work the same way now, although not so precisely, if I must say so. Can you give me a recent example? A good example is my very last electronic composition, The Resonant Island. I had this island in mind. The title always refers it to what it is, and it belongs to Rabelais, the French Renaissance writer. The idea came when I was at a venue ran by David Vassell. The place was on a slope, and it looked like an island. In French, Ilea. I also been thinking about Lac de Bourget in France, a lake that is very deep at a certain point, and as deep as the mountain next to its height. The piece refers to all these dimensions. The first part was to try to figure out how to represent the island and mountain, the second part about the water on which it reflects, and the third part dealt with the inside, the depth. Every element had to have its own sound. So it sounds different even though it's about the same thing. This is one of my main purposes of all the music that I've been doing. It is somehow the same and also different. Here I would quote Verlaine, the French poet. I'm not going to read this next part because it's completely in French, and as you can tell, no offense to anyone that's been listening, but my French is terrible. I never took it, so I'm bad. What they say in America, albeit less poetically, same, same, but different. Yes. This is to explain what I mean by having something in mind before I start. There's another funny story from one of my very good friends, Michelle Bokanowski, who is a very good composer, and who asked of me for some sounds to use in her own composition. One day she arrived asking me to do some sounds that would represent the silence of the stars. Very nice, huh? So I went to my synthesizer and I tried to figure out something. I put the sound on and she said, okay, that's it. Bingo. We obviously had the same wavelength. Through music, you can reflect anything. Sound always reflects something from the mind. Perhaps because the human mind, much like music, possesses a mathematical component and a very irrational component. You cannot explain how or why a piece of music affects you. I think I am much more instinctive than that. I had been going for a while before I met Pierre Schaeffer and Pierre Henry in their work with the 12 tones. That was intellectually very interesting. It was like a game for me. But I was not very happy with the sound. I was not fond of it. 12 tone was one element of Pierre Schaeffer and Pierre Henry's work, but another was the way they included sounds recorded from tapes in the streets, enriching the music and by extension saying that these things were sounds or music too. Concrete music became a revolutionary thing, and likewise you worked with tape too. I haven't been strictly following Pierre Henry or Pierre Schaeffer. They didn't much like what I was doing because I was not faithful to their musical principle. I was happy to work with them, and I have learned quite a lot about concrete music and how to splice tape through them, so I'm very grateful to them for that, and it was a real pleasure. I respect them, and I like their music. I like them as people and musicians, but I have my own music. There was some music I wanted to hear, and to hear it, I had to make it. It's as simple as that. When I was preparing for the interview, I listened to a lot of pieces of yours that are accessible through YouTube. It's funny to read what people write as commentaries, because, of course, this being the internet, everyone can comment on everything. Here's an example. Sounds like my old refrigerator, but it helps me sleep and contemplate about life. Elyon laughs. That's nice. I have a comment on the comment. There is a way of listening to every sound and making music out of it. The motor of an aeroplane. Not from now because they're too strong, but from years ago they had a very interesting sound that you could really make a symphony out of it just by listening to it. So I'd say yes, the way of listening is very important. So I agree with that person. Ideally, in order to avoid being annoyed by any kind of sound, you just have to make some music out of it through your ears, through the way of listening, if it's not too aggressive, of course. It's interesting that you say you didn't follow Henry or Schaefer, because you just said about every machine, every noise becoming music. It could have been them who said that. I think my meeting with Pierre Schaefer was very important because it opened my life to that idea. When I expressed my dislike, I was referring to the 12 tones music. I was unhappy with that. One thing about listening. When you listen to classical music, there's a way of listening by reading the score at the same time. It's very interesting intellectually, if you want to make an analysis. But the best way to listen to it is just, you know, let the music go. Be invited by the music. This is something important within my work, because I've always worked very much alone, except for my cat as an assistant, but she didn't say that much. So I had several ways of listening. This is why it took a lot of time, from listening freely to technical listening, that is to say, listening to the technical problems. You can listen to something 10 ways at least. Everything I've ever done has been submitted to different ways of listening, including distracted listening. What attracted you to electronic music? When I listen to your pieces, I feel drawn to these abstract soundscapes you've created. They're very long, very calm, and modulated. As a composer, you seem very patient with your music. It forces you to really listen. Of course, you get more if you really listen. My music is always changing, and if you listen to it, you can hear it. It comes from the first access I had to electronic sounds, which was the wild sounds coming from feedback. When one sound is coming from one loudspeaker and one microphone, it means when you go too near the speaker with the microphone, everything collapses, and when you go too far, it disappears. If you find the right place, which is very narrow, then you can move it very slowly and it changes, but that requires a lot of patience. The same with feedback through two tape recorders. Just by touching one knob on a recording, you may have some slight alteration, but if you go too far, everything disappears. Even with my synthesizer, I only had to move the knobs very, very slightly. This reminds me of the image of the river. It's always the same river, but at the same time, always a different one. That's true. I use this river image myself to represent one of my adnos, of which I made three in the 70s. If a stone in the river moves, the river is not changed. But after a long time, it becomes something completely different. Likewise, my music will always be changing, but slowly. It's rarely making great changes from one thing to another. You started to work acoustically, which is quite a change. Do you ever perform anything on stage, or are you simply playing a composer role? I don't play any instrument, and if I was giving a concert on tape, I would never be on stage. Once someone has claimed to have seen me on stage, but that person is a liar. I was always backstage. The final product has to be on tape because the mixing was so complex that it was impossible to reproduce it in a live concert setting. So what's the point of being on stage when everything is on tape? What I do, I insist on checking out the acoustic response in the venue, but I can do that in the rehearsal. Once that is done, that is it. Why did you start working with acoustic instruments? Acoustic instruments asked to be played, or else there would be no sound. It is almost the opposite of what you were doing with your work tapes. I'm very grateful to Casper Toplitz, who plays the electronic bass, and who insisted for a long time on asking me to do a piece with him, which I've enjoyed very much. It's a wonderful experience to work with someone, because believe me, to work just alone can be very aesthetic. I am grateful to him, because it meant that when Charles Curtis, the great cellist, asked me, I was able to say I'd give it a try, since I've only worked with acoustic musicians. There's the same difference between acoustic and recording as there is between analog and digital. There's always something missing with digital, even if it is somehow cleaner and clearer. With acoustic instruments, let's say a bell, when the first gong stops, there's a lot of different subharmonics that happen to make the music. Or, if you've just got the attack of the bell at the beginning, you have a beautiful music just floating like that. This is a natural sound. Nobody has tampered with it. It is just intonation all by itself. All acoustic instruments have that. Why would I do something which is quite difficult and painful if at the same time if I have the privilege of having these wonderful instrumentalists asking to work with me, particularly when I enjoy it so immensely. We can choose to work within a very narrow branch of music, but music is really so very, very large. I want to repeat that. We can choose to work within a very narrow branch of music, but music is really so very, very large. What a great conclusion to an interview. I hope these interviews are painting a decent picture of Elian for you. Her painstaking process of making music is truly inspiring. There is one more highlight I would like to make that I think gets us ready to discuss the Midnight album. This is a great description from another article about her song Biogenesis. When she composed Biogenesis, a classical concrete music piece and the most rhythmic of her electronic compositions, to make it, she placed a microphone and stethoscope on her pregnant daughter's extended belly and recorded the rhythms of heartbeats, then mixed these organic rhythms with flowing, extended sounds composed on the ARP synthesizer. This piece is saturated with tender memory. I'll put a link to the song Biogenesis in the description so you can check it out for yourself. I probably have gone overboard here trying to prepare you for the Midnight album, but when you're stepping into an avant-garde artist such as Radik, it really helps to have a point of reference. Now I think we are ready to discuss it. AllMusic provides this summary of the album. This profound work of electronic music on three CDs is based on the composer's complete immersion in Tibetan Buddhist teaching, and takes its title from Thomas Merton's trilogy on death. Going beyond death in this life, beyond the dichotomy of death and life, and so to become a witness to life itself. The first chapter is Kaima, composed during the years of 1985 to 1988. It was inspired by the text of the Bardo Thodol, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and it evokes the six intermediate states which constitute the existential continuity of being: Kayin, birth; Milam, dream; Samtam, contemplation and meditation; Shikai, death; Shoni, clear light; and Sipai, crossing and return. The slowly changing timbres create quite physical resonances and density modulations, suggesting encounters with traveling personalities, some comforting, some evoking deep and strange spirits. Kaima is dedicated to the composer's son, Ives Arman, who passed away in a car accident shortly before its completion. The second chapter, Kailasha, from 1988 to 1991, is an imaginary journey around the most sacred of the Himalayan mountains, Mount Kailash. But since the mountain is considered a natural mandala, the work also attempts to recreate the illusion found in the works of the visual artist Albers and Escher, where one perspective overlaps and flips over into another involuntarily. The composer considers this to be the most chaotic part of the trilogy, and deeply unnerving. Kome, the third chapter, emphasizes the transcendence of death. The title of Kome's fourth subsection quotes the Bible in Corinthians, "O death, where is thy victory? Ashes of illusion becoming light, descent to the deepest, where the spark of life is. There, death is born, death becomes birth, actively re-beginning, eternity, a perpetual becoming." This album is a commitment to take the time and make it through the long tracks. In fact, most of the tracks on here are about an hour long, but it's very rewarding when the tracks finally do begin to morph. Take, for example, the first track. Around 40 minutes in, it becomes a soft noise and a bell-like sound begins to ring. To me, at least, the spiritual journey is coming through the composition. Suddenly, a soft low-frequency hum makes its way back into the mix. The vibrations of the synthesizer and slow modulation, which she describes in her interview as being by hand, is carefully crafted. Elian envisions her music in her mind before she goes to compose. This process can take her years. She jokes about not having Pro Tools on her 75-minute tracks, and if there's a mistake at 71 minutes, she might redo the whole thing. Elian is 87 years old. I'm so glad that YouTube has some archival footage of her doing interviews and showing her at work. If you're interested in her, take the time to look at some of these interviews on YouTube. Check out the one where she has constructed a labyrinth and pumped her sounds into loops in different sections. And depending on how you walk through, you will hear a different song, therefore the person that is there will create their own. She's an amazing artist, and there's nothing ordinary about her. When considering her process and her belief and basis of her works based on Tibetan Buddhism, it really does give you a sense of accomplishment and wonder as you listen to her works. I hope you'll at least give at least one of her tracks a full listen. Make sure you set aside enough time to really take it in. Maybe read the Tibetan Book of the Dead or about it on Wikipedia as you take in her Trilogie de la Mort. Listening to this work in its terms and sound and meditative tracking to the phases of transitions from life to death process is where the work shines, in my opinion. I hope you enjoyed this discussion on field recording and our avant-garde artist, Eliane Rodiga, today. Everything about her that I have learned has just led to inspiration for me. I hope you're able to relate to her works as well. I had a good time revisiting Zen Guitar, and I hope you find a copy and read it for yourself. The value I find in it is beyond the pages usually, and it tends to spark inspiration to try and be my own self and express with less apprehension. It also reminds me that I need to put the work in, and with all the distractions life brings these days, I appreciate that reminder. I would love to hear how you all feel about field recording. Hit me up on Twitter and let me know. Try it out yourself with your smartphone. Try out FieldScaper if you want to do something creative with some recordings on your phone. It's a deep app for $10. Unfortunately, it is iOS only. I'll link that in the description also. One last thought on quarantine and field recording and Eliane Rodiga. If you're actually able to quarantine right now and you're finding some time at home, continue to do it for people like Eliane that are out there spending their final days, months, and years on this earth. These people in the nursing homes and the ones that are fortunate enough to still be living on their own are walking treasures. We need to protect them the best we can, and I guess right now the best we can do is staying home when we can. Eliane is about the same age as my grandmother. Let's take care of these people the best we can and fight stupidity if you see or hear it. I guess that's about all we can do right now. Take care and be safe out there. Everyone in the world is facing this nightmare, but we can beat it together. Till the next time, I continue to burn the midnight lamp. I hope you do too.